welcome to this horticulture-focused edition of the AHDB podcast. I'm Josh, and today we're going to be talking about all things growing media, charting its history, the development of current projects, the ramifications it has for manufacturers and growers, and the future of growing media as we begin a new decade. Wayne Broth, AHDB's Knowledge Transfer Manager of Horticulture, managed to grab a chat with Neil Bragg of Substrate Associates, Chloe Whiteside of ADAS, and Steve Carter of Tristan Plants. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the HDB podcast on the uptake of responsibility soils growing media in UK horticulture. I'm Wayne Brough, HDB Knowledge Transfer Manager for Horticulture, and joining me are Neil Bragg of Substrate Associates, Steve Carter, Tristan Plants, part of the Far Plants Group, and Chloe Whiteside of ADAS. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Morning, Wayne.
Good morning, Wayne.
Just kicking off, it was always going to be a tall order moving to peat alternative so quickly when the industry's had, what, about 80 years of experience of peat-based media?
I think that's probably a fair comment, Wayne. But the other issue is that where materials apparently are available today, they don't necessarily stay available because there are competing uses, or there are incentives to use those materials in an alternative way, which means that for horticulture, which is not a massive user of materials compared to, say, power stations burning materials, then you're not competing on a level playing field. So it's not just identifying the materials that could be used, it's also securing that supply of them against competition. So I think we need to always bear that one in mind.
Yeah, that's going to make it doubly difficult, I guess, really, isn't it? It's trying to keep that secure and also keep on top of the blends going forward as well. But I guess we can touch upon that later on in terms of looking towards the future of growing media.
Yeah.
But yeah. I guess from my perspective, in terms of what's driven all this, the petering out report in 2000 from RSPB and English Nature, I think the report set out a scenario to end commercial use of peat within 10 years.
Well, yeah, yes, it did, but it wasn't. I don't think it was the first, actually. I mean, the alarm bells had been rung in the 1990s by ecologists such as David Bellamy about the potential importance of wetlands where previously they'd been regarded as almost just barren wastelands, and therefore you could do what you liked with them. And then gradually, during the 1990s, coming up to 2000, there was this concerted concern about the eco-services position of wetlands, provision of CO2 capture. There was the water quality, reduction in the potential flood risk in areas. So I think the petering out project, yes, it probably was, if you like, markers in the sand. But I think HDC, as it was then, or AHDB Horticulture as it is now, certainly were well and the growers were well and truly on top of looking at this as an issue. If you, the industry, particularly the commercial industry, was already well developed in looking at trials of and trying to find other materials that peat could be replaced by. So I think it's a long process, and it comes back to my point about the fact that not all the materials have been available in sufficient quantities and quality to make it an easy transition.
Yes, as we were all party to it, then came the Natural England White Paper with the targets, the public sector peat ban in 2015, the MHA market 2020, and the professional sector in 2030. But I guess we've all got a story to tell on this, because I guess we were all part of the DEFRA Growing Media Task Force back then. Steve?
Yeah, I think that's right, Wayne. I mean, but just picking up Neil's point, we had been involved, you know, from the late 90s doing trials. And I think as an industry, you have to recognise that if you go back to 2000, we'd already moved from 100% peat use to roughly 95%. And then since that, in the last 20 years, we've moved to, as an industry, generally 70% peat use. And as Neil points out, plenty of trials that have happened in that time frame. Growers are certainly very, very aware of the the aims of the government, with, you know, the political landscape and the environmental pressures that we're facing. And the question we still have is customer pressures, because although some of the end users may be asking for peat free, peat reduced mixes, that isn't necessarily being picked up by the retailers.
So what we will come to sort of getting materials through the supply chain in a moment, but in terms of the drivers, I guess the main political one was the white paper, which actually set the targets. Since then, we've had the Green Future, the 25-year plan, which has enforced especially the 2030 target, and then most recently the climate change report proposing a 2023 ban on peat. I guess these are the things that just underpin to a large extent the move to responsibly sourced growing media.
Well, I think you're right in the sense that they're the most current initiatives or drivers that are focusing the industry. There is very much a case of an overall apparent policy coming down on wetlands, peatlands, whatever you want to term it, in the UK in as a whole. And this is reflected by other countries. It doesn't matter whether it's the Republic of Ireland, Switzerland, Germany, Belgium, Holland, where there is this overall arching question mark about how you utilise wetlands in the ecosystem generally, and hence the reason that the challenge then is that if peat is being extracted and used for horticulture, it doesn't matter whether it's the professional market or the hobby market, as I've sort of called it, the reality is there's going to be question marks put against us. And then, of course, at the moment, the big challenge is this whole point about zero carbon emissions. And of course, that means that people are now starting to say, well, any potential extraction process leads to the release of carbon dioxide from peat mosses, and also in the subsequent use or the transport of, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's slightly disingenuous in the sense it ignores the fact that mosses themselves, when they're reaching climax vegetation stage, actually emit things like methane, and there is a balance there. But I think it's also understood that the greater use of peat, where it's been used for fuel, and that has been its main use, actually. Horticulture is quite, if you like, minimal compared to the peat use for fuel and energy generation. Then there is obviously a direct question mark hanging in many countries, including places like Finland and Estonia, where that is their natural resource. They are also questioning then the potential curtailment of the use of peat for fuel. So yes, you're right. It's a shift in the emphasis as to what are the major drivers. And unfortunately, horticulture, I think, seems to be caught slightly in this, in the sense that I don't think horticulture is set out with any bad intent or ill intent to effectively just use peat because it was a good thing to do. It is a very relatively easy material to use in substrates, and you can balance it up, and its consistency and quality are difficult to replicate by other materials that are available. And hence the reason we've had this major R&D program that's been going on for example for the last 5 years, sponsored by DEFRA, which I Chloe might want to comment on that.
Materials we are using now were still named even back then in terms of coir and wood residues and timber products and green compost. But I think back then, though, we also had a plethora of other materials. I think there was a push, and organisations like RAP, the Waste and Resources Action Programme, were pushing to sort of use the opportunity to reuse waste materials within our industry in the hope that they could produce quality plants. And I, to a large extent, I don't think that happened, did it, really?
No, I think the reason it didn't happen, or it doesn't happen, is because the actual collection processes that are available for materials just do not exist, in the sense of you can't get good, clean arboreal waste that you might use as a compost ingredient from the type of collections that local authorities undertake. So the, in theory, the idea of collecting whatever waste it is and then being able to segregate it, compost it, and generate a consistent stream of quality material just doesn't happen in the UK. There is an issue. I mean, to be quite honest, it's exactly the same as with plastics, so there shouldn't be any surprise here. It is interesting, in Germany, there's an organisation which is badged as RAL, and they specify different levels of quality of green compost for different particular uses, and they have very strict criteria about the collection and segregation if the material is to be used as a compost or substrate ingredient. And that is the difference between us and them. The RAP theory that they came out with in the 1990s, it stands up, but it isn't doable in the UK because of the poor collection segregation.
Yeah. And there was a vast range of other materials as well. I seem to remember chopped straw, brick dust, a whole range of things where the quality wasn't there, or the consistency wasn't there, or even just the available quantities. So people had this material, but it was available in such small amounts. If there was a demand for it, it would quickly disappear. So yeah, I think a lot of... Yeah. Sorry.
No, you're right there. I mean, licorice root from Marseille was my favourite, and it still is. It leads to large movements. And the point about the licorice root is it's a good example of a material that you could use. There is no question about it. You could use it as a substrate. There just isn't enough of it. And there are competing uses, like it's burnt to generate heat. And that, therefore, you're at a loser straight away, because we don't want enough of it continuously.
Some of those early trials and the RAP ones had a negative effect on the growers, in that, you know, it was a kind of hit and miss trialing method, which meant there was some successes about it, but there was a lot of failures, and therefore it knocked the confidence in, you know, peat produced and peat free mixes, which obviously then led to further projects. And then to eventually, obviously, CP138 to talk about later on, where a different approach was taken, which is, you know, proven to be a lot more successful.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to sort of pick up on there, Steve, as well, because you're quite right. I think at that time in the timescales and the development of peat alternatives, there was almost some sort of funded program or independent trials program on alternative materials going on almost every year, looking at a wide range of different blends of ratios of stuff on different plants, and it changed from year to year depending on the season and the systems of production. And I don't think we're getting anywhere fast, to be quite honest. We were getting lots of information back, but what did it actually say at the end of the day? And you're quite right. And I think this is where the development, the creation, and the thought behind CP138, Transition to Responsibly Sourced Growing Media Use, came in. And I don't know if Chloe, now you want to say a few things about CP138, about how it came about, the concept behind it, the objectives.
Yeah, sure. So obviously we've discussed the main drivers as to why we needed to really start focusing on switching from peat to peat reduced and peat free growing media. And as you've just touched on, simply doing lots of trials year in, year out, it's a slow process. You can't always really relate results from one year to the next. Different seasons, different crops, different growers, all sorts of things which can impact on kind of translating those results year on year. So actually, CP138 was looking at a different approach and trying to make those results more transferable. So if you take the kind of the four, what we see as the four key raw materials, peat alternatives, so coir, wood fibre, bark, and green compost, we all know that wood fibre is a very broad term. There's all sorts of different types of wood fibre, different ways in which it's produced. So actually just saying we used wood fibre, you know, one person's wood fibre is not the same as another person's wood fibre. But if you can characterise those raw materials in terms of their physical properties, so their available water, their airflow porosity and their dry bulk density, the things that we really know help characterise a material, then you can start to understand a little bit more about those materials, and then you can start to actually transfer results from one to another because they're a bit more easy to understand. So that was the approach of CP138, was actually focusing on the physical aspects of the raw materials and developing that into a model. So a tool that the industry can use going forwards. So characterising a range of materials for their physical properties and seeing how they all fit together and creating blends based on that. So kind of blends based on numbers, really, rather than just 70% this, 30% that. Well, now let's try 40% this, 60% that. So kind of putting a bit more kind of numbers behind it, I guess, was the approach that we decided to take.
But I guess it was a little bit more than that. As Steve said earlier, there was a confidence issue about materials used previously not performing. And I think part of CP138 was also building this confidence back up in these materials.
Yeah, I mean, so it was a big project. It wasn't just ADAS. There was Stockbridge Technology Centre and Quadrum Institute Bioscience involved as well. And then obviously grow media manufacturers and growers. So the growers spanned across all the sectors of horticulture. And we didn't just do experimental work at our set up in Cambridge. We also did a lot of commercial grower work. So out on a range of sites, bedding and pot plants, highly nursery stock, veg propagation, herbs, all over the country. And so for growers to then see firsthand how these blends are performing was really key. And we did do a lot of workshops, particularly later on in the project, so that people could come and visit the trials and really see how things are doing. And I think that really started to help build the confidence a bit, because this method of using the physical properties was producing good blends for us to grow plants in, and people could start to see that actually it can be done. And like you said, there is that kind of memory from 20 odd years ago that, oh, peat-free doesn't work, and, you know, why should we bother? But actually, we're starting to kind of dispel that myth, I think. And this project has really helped to kind of showcase that on a wide range of crops as well.
Yes, at the same time as CP138, there was another project going on as well, which was trying to clarify what responsibly sourced materials are. I don't know if you've got any sort of explain the model and the concept going on there, Neil.
Well, I mean, after the Environment Bill came through in 2011, DEFRA set up a task force, which they appointed Dr. Alan Knight, who'd been responsible at B&Q for the FSC scheme, the Forestry Stewardship Scheme, with regard to timber selection. And Alan made it quite clear at an outset that, first of all, as an industry, you couldn't rely on one material. So therefore, he was basically saying just to have an industry that relies on peat is a little bit silly because it's vulnerable. And that's clearly what's happening. And then he was basically saying, you need to forget the word sustainable, because the problem with the word sustainable is it's an incredibly difficult argument to meet. With the outcomes. And even if you said that the particular material, that your component you were taking was sustainable, you'd have all the arguments about the plastic bag used to wrap it, the inks, the fertilizers, the wetting agents, whatever. So we became the responsible sourcing group. And there were a number of projects, 12 projects, which were set up, of which number four was to develop guidelines for assessing materials against a set of criteria. It didn't matter whether it was the energy used by them or whether it was the water used in the processing, biodiversity, habitat, pollution, renewability. These criteria were looked at across the piece, so all the materials could be assessed against the criteria. And a calculator was set up, which runs actually on Excel spreadsheet, as an Excel spreadsheet. And you put in your data. Once you've looked at the material, you look at the supply chain for the particular material, you add up all the various bits that go into, say, the energy consumption in producing the material. And then the calculator gives you a score between 1 and 20 for the particular material, one being the worst case, so it's in the red because they're using a traffic light scoring. Then there's an amber range, and then yellow and green at the top of the sort of 18 to 20 part of the range. And all materials can be assessed on this basis. The important thing is you can also take any new material and put it through the process of arriving at the guideline sort of tables for the material, which can be fed into the calculator, and then you can actually develop it. So it's a quite different approach to a lot of those that you see abroad at the moment, where it's life cycle analysis specific, and that's very much on sustainability, whereas this is trying to say, let's look at all materials in an even-handed way against a set of criteria and come up with a score for them. And if you then take them in mixes, you can see the interplay of, if I've got 20% of one material at the moment and I increase it to 40, how does it affect the overall score compared to, say, being 100% of another material? So it is actually, despite being difficult to get it up and running, it's now at the point where manufacturers are using it to assess, and growers and other people are saying, well, could we see the scores for your particular range of materials? And then, of course, it leads us into the possibility of having it as part of an accreditation scheme, so you can actually put a label on bags or on specifications going to growers, which actually indicates the, if you like, the responsible level of that particular product at the end. So it's fairly progressive in that sense, I think.
And it puts peat into some sort of context as well, Neil, in terms of the responsibility, the level of responsibility of all the other materials. We don't simply want to move from peat to, say, coir or some other material and find we're in the same position again 5 years down the line.
Yeah, I mean, that's very important. I mean, we're not trying to say peat is good. We're not trying to say peat is bad. What we're saying is this is how it looks against the criteria that you are assessing it against. And I'll be the first to say, under renewability, obviously it scores very badly. Other materials might score very badly against the use of water for washing them in the processing. The question is, can you improve the process behind that for the individual material? And if, by altering the proportions within the mixes, can you effectively improve the overall score of the particular product that you're supplying? And this is, if you like, for me, this is an intelligent discussion which suppliers, users, and end users, retailers, customers can actually appreciate. And as long as it's clearly translated onto a label that people can understand and appreciate, then I think we are getting very close to meeting some of the questions that have been put to the industry.
I think looking at the situation today, we've been through a period of what I would sort of say is relative stability with the use of peat-based media. Now we're moving into, well, you could call it more exciting times, I guess. Just wondering, in the short term, what does this mean for sort of grain media manufacturers in terms of sourcing and blending materials, but also in terms of growers moving from, many will be moving from 30% peat reduction to peat-free. What are your comments about that?
From a manufacturer's point of view, it means that they have to be out there selecting a wider range of components, but then they have to take those components, be it coir, bark, wood fibres, composted green waste, they have to take them through this responsible sourcing calculator to assess the particular criteria for the assess the material against the criteria and arrive at the scores for them. It then means, from the if you're supplying growers, the grower needs to know what the components are, and they need to have confidence about the way those components are going to behave in the mix. Does it mean that the machinery handling the actual material will have to be reset slightly to adjust? And this was part of this project that Chloe was referring to about the handleability of new mixes. It didn't appear to be too bad for all the mixes we used, but there are obviously always adjustments depending on the different type of machinery. It reflects on then the irrigation requirement for the particular materials. How do you know when they're moist? Do you know how much available water they're going to have? And therefore, they effectively the on nursery shelf life. And you need to adjust the fertilizers that you apply to the crop. Will there be more chance of leaching? Will there be more need for fertilizers to be applied secondary to effectively make sure the crop is in quality performance? So it's a very much an integration between the manufacturer sourcing materials, the grower actually experiencing those materials, looking at how they handle, how they water, what their nutrient requirements are, and then a joint feedback between those. And that's where CP138 has been very good, because the project Chloe's been describing there actually has looked at across the piece, from trees through to bedding plants to vegetable transplants, really a whole range of crops in different pots and different containers under different irrigation, different fertilizer regimes. And it's actually been very positive, but I think it needs to be, if you like, that message needs to be continued. You can't just say, oh, well, we've done this, therefore we stop. We need to actually continue to see that demonstration of good practice. And I think that's one of the real challenges now for us as an industry, and I think with government support, I think that's essential, actually.
Definitely. Steve, would you like to expand?
Already, with regards to growing medium material becoming available, one of the critical things, the confidence going forward that the material will be available, you know, not just next year, but in 5 years' time, because what growers need is consistency, so that they know each year that the material they're going to be using will perform. And obviously, in order to change materials, you need to trial it first and feel confident material before you commit what are quite often large sums of money into your production. Picking up some of the things that Neil didn't mention with regards to growing media, what it means for growers. Shelf life is obviously important, because some of the early trials that were done in 2000 or so meant that the material worked well at the grower's site, but when it then got put into retail, the product dried out too quickly and therefore gave a very short shelf life for the customers. We also need to consider interactions with pest and disease. So we know particularly things like scarab fly will be impacted by the growing media that you're using. And then finally, overwintering, we've not mentioned, of particularly hardy nursery stock. There is a concern that a more open mix may lead to more damage of the roots in frosty conditions. So there's been a lot of work that has been demonstrated in the work that Chloe's done with CP138. But as Neil said, it's not the end of the road. At the end of the day, we've only trialled a number of species and a number of circumstances, and each grower needs to do further work in their own conditions in order to gain that confidence that they will be able to move forward with the new mixes that are coming online.
What's your thoughts about the so-called elephant in the room about the pricing and getting these new materials and the products grown in them through the supply chain? Do you think that's going to be an issue going forward, or do you think things are changing and the price increases will inevitably come about?
Well, for me, yeah, there's two, as I phrase them, blockers. One is price, and the other one is flexibility. So growers are used to using peat as a kind of one-size-fits-all for a variety of crops. And what we've learned from the trials is that a mix that works for crop A may not work for crop B, and vice versa. That therefore adds potential wastage into growing and a need for an increase in the number of mixes that you're using, which adds complexity and adds cost. But also, as you mentioned, the price of the material, the belief is, the understanding is, the economics mean that because some of these materials are more heavier, they're more costly to transport, because they may need to be sourced from further afield, the price of the growing media will go up, which will therefore impact on the price to the end user. To answer your question, there does seem to be within the marketplace at the moment, because of all the other changes that are going on with regards to labour requirements, with regards to the cost of labour going up, particularly issues with plastics, supply issues, particularly with regards to, dare I mention, the B word, the likely impact on the industry is that prices will go up, and the growing media element of that is just one factor.
Okay.
So I believe that the end consumer is more than willing to pay higher prices, particularly for good environmental reasons. However, we do still see blockers at the retailer end where they are less inclined to pay for that increased cost.
Kind of looking forward to the future of grain media and where next, do you think, Neil, that peat extraction will actually cease around the world in the near future?
I genuinely think, despite comments from Grain Media Europe and the Eastern Bloc, the Baltic states, I think there will be an environmental upsurge of pressure to see peat removed from general use. I say general use because I think there may be specific areas where the use of peat is limited but accepted because it's very, very difficult to replace it, such as the brassica transplant area. But I mean, that, you know, in terms of total volume is minute, and it's very difficult to envisage a situation where you were, inverted commas, extracting specifically for a particular sector. So I think the way the environmental pressures are going at the moment and the way the NGOs are dominating, in many cases, the arguments about wetland preservation, emission control, etc., I think we're almost inevitably set on a course where over 5 to 10 years, we will see almost entirely peat being taken out of growing media. It's not a question whether it's right or wrong. It's just a fact that that's almost inevitably going to happen.
And you mentioned before in terms of price competition from other industries for materials like wood chip, do you feel there's going to be a consistent, well, a continuous change of potential alternatives depending on the pressure from other industries for the materials?
Well, I'm seriously trying to have a discussion with government department now about the point about incentivization. Our community has been incentivized to burn wood for energy production. I would suggest that it either that ought to stop in order to make the playing field level, because if a lot of our products are going to be timber based in one sort or another, therefore it's unfair for the horticulture industry to be challenged to use other materials if it's not a level playing field with regard to the price of those materials because another sector is being incentivized to use them. So seriously trying to get that discussion going, and it's something I think we need to pursue, to be quite honest.
And Steve, from a grower's perspective, how do you see the future panning out in terms of growing media?
I think there's likely to be a lot of change, and growers need to adapt. And to be honest with you, that's what growers do. Whether it be from season to season or from year to year, we have to adapt how we're doing it. I see this as being a journey. I think Neil mentioned it earlier that, you know, we're only partway through the process. There's a lot of work still to be achieved in order to get to the end result where government wants us to be for that 2030 target. You know, and we need to work collectively together as an industry with growing media manufacturers, with our customers, with all our other suppliers, with our irrigation suppliers, research bodies, in order to achieve, where we need to be.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. For any further information about growing media, please visit ahdb.org.uk. Also, don't forget to subscribe to our channel by searching for AHDB on your favourite podcast app. Our next podcast will be delivered by our cereals and oilseeds team, covering all things RB209. Catch you next time.